Okay, so we had started yesterday the topic of Tevila, this crucial stage, if not the crucial stage, certainly a crucial stage in the Geirus process. And we started considering some of the practical issues. And today we'll continue with some of the practical issues, also framing them as far as how exactly they tie into some of the Lamdisha concepts. So one thing to make note of, so as we saw yesterday, that on the one hand, we know that there is a requirement, at least l'chadchila, to treat it like a Maisa Bezdin that needs to be done with certain conditions, needs to be done in front of a Bezdin, needs to be done during the daytime, needs to be done not on Shabbos, needs to be done presumably with awareness and intent of what is going on. And opposing all that, it seems, is that there is a Gemara, at least the way some of the Rishonim understand it, and the way it is referred to in Shulchan Aruch as well, that seems to call all that into question, because the Gemara has a possibility that someone could become a ger through a tefillah that was done for the purposes of nida, or in the case of a man, was done for the purposes of tahara from keri. So that seems to throw all this into a tailspin, because presumably, let's say, for example, the woman who's going to the mikvah for nidus, so she's doing that at night, she's doing it probably without a bezdin, she's doing it in a whole different context. And the question of kavana seems to be very much present. If she's doing it thinking it's for this purpose of hilchas nida, so then it doesn't sound like the kavana for geirus is present. So that's an issue that everyone deals with. And some of the Rishonim, again, don't understand the Gemara to mean that. The Rambam, for example, and one of the Deis and Rashi, but it is referenced in Shulchan Aruch like that, so it's a major issue. But in the Sefer Al-Ger HaTzedek, thanks again to Moshe Blank for sending to me, so there is a suggestion, I think some others have like this as well, that it's not completely disconnected, at least as far as the Kavana issue is concerned, because somebody who's going to the mikvah for the purposes of Tara, Tara from Nida, Tara from Keri, whatever it is, so that still has the theme of joining into the Kedusha and Tara of Klal Yisrael. So it's not completely disparate from the notion of Geirus, and that maybe that's something to hold on to. And there is what to consider. It parallels to some extent the question when it came to Mila. We know Mila is both a mitzvah and a stage in Geirus, and the question could be asked if they overlap in that way, especially when it comes to Mila also, that even Mila by a baby born Jewish is about bringing this baby into the covenant. So it's not a completely separate idea. So the notion that it's something that exists in the pantheon of mitzvos and also exists as a part of Geirus, so on the one hand, that seems to give it two distinct identities, and they could be confused with each other. But on the other hand, they're not necessarily so different, that even looking at them as mitzvahs, looking at both of them as mitzvahs, there are aspects that are particularly relevant to Geirus, and that's something to keep in mind. In the Sefer Harei Kedem, there's a quotation from Rav Soloveitchik on the point also about where exactly the tvila of Geirus fits into the Geirus of Tara, and how exactly they're to the tefillah of Tara, and how exactly their symbolism and their imagery overlaps. So that is something to keep in mind. Okay, so with that, we'll consider some of the other issues that we'll see today. But a matter of practicality, so we left off yesterday with this question of Shechiyonu. So is there a Shechiyonu recited after the tefillah? So the Radbaz, in his Shuvas, was the one who advocated a Shechiyonu. Sin Taflam Adalid, and he's quoted in the Pischei Tshuva. For the most part, it doesn't seem to be the minig to do this, although there were those who did. The Rabbi Pesach Frank has it in his Geirus Seder, and it was the minig in Tunisia, as the Tshuvas Ish Matzliach testifies. But for most of us, we don't find the practice of reciting Shehecheyanu. There were those who thought maybe you should bring a Pri Chodesh with, you should bring some other new item, new experience, in order to be Yotze, in order to cover the Shehecheyanu theme, perhaps. But one way or another, it doesn't seem to be the prevalent practice. The Sridi Eish actually wrote that a male ger could make a Shehecheyanu after the Mila. So that's only going to address a part of the population. But the idea of a Shehecheyanu after the Tefillah, so despite the fact that you have this Radbaz and the Pesachei Tshuva, doesn't seem to be a widely observed practice. So why not? Why isn't it something that has taken off? So there is a tshuva about this in the Tshuvas van Hagos, where he has a perspective. We have to make sure to place it in the right context. So he notes that when it comes to a bris milah, so we also don't make a Shehecheyanu. That's also a matter of minhag, as Sfaradim do, the different practices as far as making a Shehecheyanu for a milah. But the assumption that we don't, which also could connect to other things that we don't do at a bris milah, some explain based on the idea of Tzara D'Yanuka, that it's not a completely happy event. The baby doesn't seem so happy. He's crying, so we feel bad for his pain. So therefore, we don't allow ourselves to make the Shehecheyanu in this unreserved way. So he incorporates that kind of concern here. But we have to be careful how we phrase this, is that when it comes to taking on all the chiyuvim mitzvos, so as the Gemara indicated, it's not necessarily a straight-out benefit, that who knows what's going to happen. Now, when I say we should be careful, I don't think we want to associate this with the idea of a Shveretz Zayin Yid, as we mentioned at one point earlier, that's where Moshe Feinstein had always emphasized how destructive a message that is. It's not that we're saying, don't be so excited that you're Jewish, it's going to be a hard ride. But the point is that maybe we don't know yet, that we don't know if a person's going to be a tzaddik and he's going to live up to all the expectations. So then this is a wonderful simcha. But because we don't know yet how it's going to turn out, so we're not ready to make a Shehecheyanu. And the Menuchas Yitzchok says something similar to that without necessarily some of the background that Rav Sternbach was bringing into it, but essentially making this point that we don't yet know how it's going to turn out, so we're not ready to make a Shehecheyanu yet. Tyler, you have a question about that?
Yeah, this might not be a fair question, but can Rebbe give the basic halacha of Shehecheyanu?
That is a big that is a big tangent. Maybe we'll have to find time to talk about that in greater detail at a different time. There are at least a few full volumes on that topic. But the assumption, we find it sometimes connected with mitzvos that happen on only certain occasions, and we find it sometimes associated with joyous life events. So, and we find it sometimes associated with new acquisitions, which is very relevant now to, it was already the 9 days, but even for the 3 weeks, the idea of not buying new clothes during the 3 weeks is associated with the Shehecheyanu, the idea that we feel very dissonant to say during the 3 weeks, we're so happy to be brought to this time, so we don't want to bring ourselves into that situation. So the idea that Shehecheyanu has this connection to all of those happy times, so you could hear that Geirus would be a good time for it, and yet, despite the fact that it was advocated by some Rishonim and some Achronim, doesn't seem to be this widespread practice. So that's the question they were addressing. Why not?
It would be a big problem, Rebbe, right? If you had to make a Shehecheyanu, then during 9 days and certain times, what we just quoted?
Yeah, the Radbaz says to make it.
So would he say you can't do it during 9 days, or no, it's not?
So it's a good question, interesting question. I don't know if anyone ever brought that up. We do find, in terms of the halachas of the 3 weeks, that we distinguish between something that you could do later and something that you need to do now. So if, you know, be given that we see this whole idea of not pushing off Geirus once it's ready, so I don't think, even if you assume that there's a Shehecheyanu associated with it, I don't think we would say to push it off for that purpose, I would guess. But in the Sefer, Al-Gerah HaTzedek, which is what prompted, I think, Moshe yesterday to bring it up, he has a whole analysis of this, very interesting. So he says that if you want to follow the Menchas Yitzchak, who he talks about, that there is this question of who knows how it's going to turn out, so then maybe there is a Lumdish Hezber to say about the different Minhagim. And just to spend a minute on it, that he notes that Shulchan Aruch quotes the din that if you have a ger who reverts to his old pre-Jewish ways, stops being involved in Jewish practice, so then he is going to negatively impact wine that he contacts, that he touches. So the Prisha raises the question that, well, that should be obvious, because if he is a non-observant Jew, it would seem like that would have that halacha anyway. So why is that of interest here? It should be true for any Jew, whether they're converted or not. So the Prisha suggests that maybe what it does is it means even before he started behaving that way, it retroactively has that impact on wine that he touched before it was clear that that's how he was behaving. And the Taz says, no, that can't be, because from the moment he converts, so once it's a kosher conversion, so then he is Bechezkas Tzaddik. So then we assume, until we know later, that he's treated as a righteous person. And if he starts behaving improperly later, so then that will affect from that point on, but it's not going to have any retroactive impact. So he thought maybe that was the issue, that do we assume that from the moment of conversion this individual is a tzaddik and therefore it's a unadulterated simcha and let him just say shachianu, or are we kind of waiting to see how it's going to turn out and then maybe we're a little bit hesitant and maybe that's why. But that also puts this most of us in this kind of negative mindset, because most of us don't have this practice of shachianu. So you know, how far you want to go with the Sesber is a good question. It's an interesting idea to ponder, especially during these weeks when our approach to Shechianu is itself somewhat complicated. Okay, so in any event, so what about the very significant and very practical issue of the Beis Din? And that we'll just try to speak about for a few minutes, because it has major implications. So we will talk, God willing, next week about the broader issues of the role of Beis Din in Geiris and how it impacts other things such as the Kabbalas HaMitzvos and the like, and what are the standards for Dayanim and where does it come from. All of that will, God willing, deal with in the very near future. But as far as it relates to this concept, to the tefillah, so what do we do about that? So is there a requirement for Beis Din associated with the tefillah? So this was a big machlokas, because on the one hand, it sounds from some lines in the Gemara that this all happens in front of the Beis Din, and you have those such as the Bahag, for example, that just say straight out that it requires a Beis Din. And you have the impression from the Shulchan Aruch that certainly l'chadchila it requires a Beis Din. And you have the position of the Rambam in the Rif that the Shulchan Aruch also quotes, that has a kind of l'chadchila and b'dieved distinction in a somewhat different way, that they understand that if somebody were to convert with a tefillah that was not in front of Beis Din, so then they would not be eligible to marry a Jew. We would not be confident enough in the conversion to allow that. But if they did get married and they have children, so then we wouldn't have any question about the status of the children, because apparently to that level of b'dieved we would rely on the geiris. So it's a pretty weak b'dieved, meaning that it's not like, okay, we're okay with it, we're moving forward. We would require another tefillah for this individual to get married. But as far as it relates to the children, so that much b'dieved they would accept. So this is a big question, because we have this impression that we get from some of the sources that we do need the Beis Din. On the other hand, so like we said at the beginning of today, and we could discuss yesterday, so what about this issue of Tevila for Nida or for Tara, where the assumption is that presumably there wasn't a Beis Din there? So how do you deal with that? If that's indeed the case, that you could have a Tevila for Nida count, so how is that going to work if you require a Beis Din? So there's a whole range of approaches, just to give a sense of the range. So you could say that it's just a machlokas in the different sources, and that Lamaisa Nida Beis Din, that's the end of the story. Or maybe this mistake, that let's say this woman was Tovel for Nida, that was what she thought, but Lamaisa, there really was a Beis Din present, and it really was being covered as a Geiris Tvila. Or, like some of the Tosfosin that we saw, two Tosfosin in Yevamos, and elsewhere, either that this is a requirement l'chadchila, but a Geiris and a Tevila done not in front of Beis Din could still be acceptable. Or maybe what in front of Beis Din means is subject to discussion. So perhaps if the Beis Din is aware of it, even if they're not actually physically present, that could also count. So one of the other Tosfosin we saw in Yevamos has that possibility, that if they know about it, that counts. So since everyone knows she's behaving as a religious person, so therefore she's going to the mikveh when it's relevant in from Hilchos Nida, so therefore even though they don't actually see her doing that, but it's a known fact, so then maybe that counts as being in the presence of Beis Din. Hi, Philip.
Can we say that maybe the Balanit has some sort of status? Because just like she can watch the woman be Tovelas and she can confirm that it was done properly, so too here.
Yes, so that is going to come into the discussion when we try to figure out the practicalities in a minute of contemporary Geiris for women. So that is definitely going to be an issue. But first, dealing with it historically, the question of what does that source mean for this requirement, how do we reconcile the idea that we would need a Beis Din, and yet the Gemara can testify about this case where this woman was considered converted based on a Nida Tevila. We don't know that that's coming from the testimony of the mikveh lady. So how exactly are we addressing that? So it could be just that it's known, might be enough, which is similar to what we find in the laws of Kiddushin, that Kiddushei Bia. So when you have the concept of a couple that's married because they are living together, which is not what we recommend for a religious couple, but the question is, if it's the reality, is that something that is considered to be a valid Kiddushin? So what about the fact that there's no Eidim, so nobody is watching that happen? So there we say that the basic knowledge that they have about what's going on is effective for Eidus. So maybe there's a similar standard here, that the Beis Din doesn't have to actually witness what's happening, but their knowledge of it is considered to be Bifnei Beis Din. So that's a question. There is a lot of alumnus about this, and keep it in mind when we explore further the role of Beis Din, God willing, next week. But just for example, so there's a short piece about this in the Sefer Zichron and Shmuel, which is the collected writings of Shmuel Rozovsky, the great Magid Shir from Panevich, the very well-known, in the 1960s, Shmuel Rozovsky was known as one of the most popular Megiddo Shir in the world, and his Shirim on many Masechtas are printed in many different versions. There's also a separate Sefer called Zichron Shmuel, which has a lot of his letters and collected writings outside the context of his Masechta Shirim. So one of them is about this. He was asked about this question, about whether the idea of a Beis Din for Geiris, does that require that the Beis Din actually physically witness what's happening? Or does it suffice that the Beis Din know what's going on? And he comes at it from a lumdisha perspective, and the question of comparing it to chalitza and what exactly is the role of Bezdin in chalitza. And there he is inclined to conclude that they don't have to actually witness it, but they have to know it halachically. And the context he was talking about, the testimony would have been from a non-Jewish woman, he makes reference to, which is not enough for halachic knowledge. So there the realities come into play. What is going to constitute actual knowledge? But if we can rely halachically on there being sure this happened, then he wouldn't actually need to see it the way he understood it. He also gets into the discussion there about the whole notion of whether Geirus requires Eidus in the sense of Eidus Lukium Hadaver. So we know that when it comes to a marriage, for example, so we need Eidim to be present, and we know that Eidim in Halacha serve different functions. So there is a notion of Eidei Birur, right, that you have a Bezdin that's trying to establish the facts of what happened, so they need Eidim to come and clarify the realities, what they know about. And we also have an idea of Eidei Kiyum, that there are certain status changes that only happen through the presence of Eidim, like we have at a wedding. So what exactly is the story? Does Eidus require Eidus Lekiyum Hadaver? So he also tends to assume it doesn't actually need Eidus Lekiyum Hadaver. We just need to clarify that this is something that actually happened. It gets into the question, which he also discusses there, that the Gemara tells us that a Davar Shebe'erva requires two Eidim. The question is, what is the definition of a Davar Shebe'erva? So this is a issue which was a machlokis. There are probably four different shitas on what is considered to be a Davar Shebe'erva. Does that mean, like it sounds, it has to do with Arayos, that it's talking about the existence or lack of existence of a Arayos issue, or is it about anything to do with personal status, like some understood, or is it about anything to do with people as opposed to Issa v'Heter? So there are different opinions as to what is the definition of a Davar Shebe'erva that requires Eidim, and that's one of the issues that he gets into. And similarly, the question of whether the Bezdin by a Geirus, does a Bezdin, does that mean that Geirus is a Maisa Bezdin? Or is it not? Is it something that is requiring, that we require to have in front of a Bezdin, but it doesn't mean that it's actually a function of Bezdin? So these are all Lumdisha questions which are in the background here of the reality of what is required as far as the Tvila process is concerned. So this becomes a big issue, as you could imagine, for the issue of women who are converting. So when you have a tefillah for a female, and as Tosfos emphasizes in Yevamos, the dayanim are male, that's how we assume la halacha, and Tosfos certainly takes that as a given. So the clear tznius problem and a major obstacle, having a woman immerse unclothed in a mikveh in the presence of a panel of men. So how exactly does that work? Is it necessary in the first place? And if it is necessary, so how does it work? So here there is a whole discussion. It's pointed out that in the Maseches Gerim, so it says that a man is tovel a man and a isha is tovel as a isha. So one could read that to mean that there isn't a Bezdin present, there's just a woman present. And some understand the process to be that the Bezdin would be present in an adjacent room, and they would just know what's going on, but they wouldn't necessarily be physically witnessing it. And there is a history behind that. It is a safer Geirus is written by Reb Gershom HaGozer, who lived about 800 years ago, the time of the Rishonim, and is often quoted. So the way he records it, that's how it would happen, that the Bezdin would be adjacent. And even in later generations, there are those who had such a practice, Reb Shmuel Salant, who we've made reference to a few times for his various positions in Geras. He had such a practice, as the way it's recorded in later Svarim. And others very much felt that that's not sufficient, that you have to have a Beis Din present witnessing. And the Pesachei Tshuva quotes, here in the Shulchan Aruch, Pesachei Tshuva quotes the Parach Mata Aaron as saying that if the Beis Din did not witness the tefillah, then they're going to have to do it again, that it's Ma'akev. So it's a question how to reconcile all of these sources. And on the one hand, the sources in the Rishonim that say it's only L'chadchila, or knowledge of it is enough, with other sources saying that they have to actually witness it, and the way it sounds like, and also this Maseches Gerim that sounds like women are doing it for women and men are doing it for men. That is probably the easiest to resolve, as some of the Sfarim point out, that presumably what that means is that the actual process of the tefillah, of getting her ready for the tefillah and bringing her to the mikvah and making sure that it's happening properly as far as Hilchos Tevilah is concerned, so that is overseen by a female, just like a tefillah of a mikvah. But it doesn't exclude the possibility that a female will escort her into the mikvah and bring her to that stage, and then the Beis Din will come in and watch the actual immersion. It's possible that they both can be true. So Rav Sternbuch, for example, has a tshuva about this, among many others, where he notes that he thinks, on the one hand, that the thrust of the sources, the way the Gemara sounds like, and especially the Rambam sounds like, is that this is happening bifnei Beis Din. This is happening in the physical presence of the Beis Din, and he doesn't understand why one would think otherwise, why one would think that it doesn't require a Beis Din. He thinks the simple presentation is that it is happening in front of the Beis Din. But then he acknowledges that, okay, so there's a Tosfos here and a Tosfos there. There are some sources that do seem to allow for other possibilities. So it seems like we have here somewhat of a Safek. So his recommendation is that in a situation he was dealing with where the tefillah was done not in the presence of the Beis Din, that he recommended that before marriage they did do another tefillah just to be sure about everything. But he would also emphasize that it should be made clear that she's completely kosher ger, and there shouldn't be any question, and this should be done in private, and that there should be a tuuda that should testify to her complete validity. So it's a somewhat tricky point. But again, this is an issue that is a whole discussion about in the poskim. Rav Adi Yosef has a tshuva about it, the Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about it, and Rav Adi's tshuva, he talks at length about his history as a dayan in Egypt before he came to Eretz Yisrael and later became the chief rabbi, and what he saw there. And essentially what you seem to find in most poskim, and I believe this is the practice of the Beis Din of America and the Geras protocols that they currently adopt, is to assume that yes, the Beis Din does have to be there for the tefillah. So how does that work as far as Tznius is concerned? So first of all, so she's brought into the water before they come in, and that's what this female does, and then she's immersed up until her neck, so her head is out of the water for that last stage of being informed of the mitzvos again and accepting the mitzvos. But as far as the tznius considerations, that the water being clear is not going to help that much, although it's interesting, Bavadja does talk about in his tshuva about maybe differences between Egypt and Eretz Yisrael as far as how clear the water is. Maybe there's a difference between murky water and clear water as far as what was done. But there are various suggestions that either she could wear very loose clothing, which would allow water to reach every part of the body despite the fact that it's otherwise covered, which is a suggestion you sometimes find for a nida who has to go to the ocean and has to be in a somewhat public place, that might be a etza. or that there is a big garment that is held up between her and the males, or, as many of the poskim discussed and Ravad discusses and others, to have something which has a hole in it so that the head can come through, but the rest of the body would be covered, and that would allow for the Beis Din to see her head on top of the water about to go in, but not to see anything else. And also to have them standing at somewhat of a distance, so they're also aware that it's her there, but not seeing too clear of a picture of anything else. All of these are incorporated into what's there to protect its tzniyus. Thank you again to Moshe for that sefer on Geiris, where there he brings a number of different approaches of what he's seen in contemporary Batei Din, three or four different ways to address this obscuring of the picture that allows for the Beis Din to be there, but not to see anything they shouldn't be seeing. And it's also, you know, important to appreciate that this is something which is an issue in medical offices and other contexts as well. And we rely on professionals in good faith to have the right intentions and the right practices to do what needs to be done, while also protecting the very important consideration, both halachically and emotionally and psychologically. It's all on every level a very serious consideration to prevent any halachic violation and any sense of personal violation. So certainly with the requisite sensitivity, that's something that can be done. And this is the attitude that most of the poskim seem to have, that the Beis Din does indeed need to be there. Tyler, you had a question about that?
Yes, I just want to confirm, when we say the head, they watch the head go in, that means that the head is the last part of the body that's going in, right? Meaning it's the whole body that needs to go in, they're just seeing.
Right, and they're not diving.
And they're assuming that that is the most sneeze way to do it, but you can also confirm that that is basically their whole body.
Right, so you see, so when they come in, they'll see a head above the water, but her body's in the water. So she prepares that much before they would be involved. And then at that point, she can answer the questions and can accept the mitzvos for that final time. But the question is still, the water is going to cover the rest of her body, but the water is usually transparent, not always, as we've seen. So is that enough of a coverage? So how do you address making it more covered when, despite the fact that the water is transparent? So either having a cloth of some kind, either in front or on top of her with a hole for the head, or maybe even wearing a loose garment, that's its own possibility, together also with the Beis Din standing a distance away. You know, each to its own degree and each to its own practice, but all of those contributing to allowing them to be aware that it's her in the mikveh and yet not seeing anything that they shouldn't see. Okay, so those are some of the main issues. Again, still a lot to determine about the Beis Din itself and about the Kabbalah Samitzvah. So those are the topics next up. But let's just quickly recap what we spoke about today. So we got back into this issue of the assumption that tefillah should require a certain kavana and other conditions, and yet we have the Gemara, as some of the Rishonim read it, that a tefillah for the sake of nida or tara for a man could also count as the tefillah for geiris. How do you reconcile that? And as far as the kavana is concerned, so we mentioned this idea that some have, that it's not a completely separate theme, that having intention for a tara is similar to the intention one would have to enter the Kedushas Yisrael, and therefore it's not like it's completely separate from the idea of Geiris. And then we talked about this question of the Shachianu, which the Pesachei Tshuva quotes from the Radbaz, and if you did have this practice, Ritzi Pesach Frank and the Tunisians, as the Ish Matzliach testifies. But for the most part, we don't have this. This really says a male could say it after the Mila, but for the most part, for tefillah, we don't see it. So question, why not? So we saw that Rav Sternbach and also the Menachas Yitzchak talk about the fact that we don't know how it's going to turn out, and maybe it's not yet a total simcha. I try not to get too depressed about that mentality. But in the Sefer Al Gariat Tzedek, thanks again to Moshe Lenk, he talks there about maybe it's Tully and a Machlokas, which essentially boils down to, do we assume that there is a Chezkas Kashrus from the moment that they convert, or are we still kind of just waiting and seeing how it's going to turn out, so it's not yet a time for Shechianu? And then we got into the specifics of this Bez Din issue, which we noted is complicated on a couple levels, that a number of sources in the Gemara and Rishonim sound like it requires a Bez Din. On the other hand, especially this idea of the Nida Gemara sounds like it doesn't require Bez Din. It's not the only source also. There are a few other sources that call that into question. So we have to figure out how you reconcile that. And we mentioned that there are various approaches, some that just say it's machlokas among different sources, but bottom line, it requires a Bez Din. Some make a distinction between the Chachila and B'di'evid. The Rambam and the Rif having a particularly strong B'di'evid here, saying B'di'evid only in terms of that children will be unaffected by it, but an adult who wants to marry after a tefillah, not in front of Bez Din, will have to do it again. Others who say that it's just a Chachila straight out, like Tosfos suggests, or that maybe Bez Din doesn't have to actually witness it, Bez Din just has to know about it, and that's enough. So we have all these views in the Rishonim, and in terms of what actually happens, a few other issues involved also, is it like Shmorzovsky's discussion and others, is it something that has to happen as a Maisa Bez Din, or just with a knowledge of Bez Din? Is there a requirement for Edus Lakiyum Hadavar, or just that we should know about it as a matter of public awareness? And the issue is particularly relevant for female converts. The Maseches Gerim saying a woman is Tovel a woman, and some earlier sources also indicating that the Bez Din was adjacent but not actually witnessing it. So this became a major discussion in Poskim over the years, and with the majority of Poskim holding nowadays that the Bez Din really does have to see it. And the question then, okay, so how do we accommodate Tznius under those circumstances? So we talked about the fact that first, before the Bez Din even comes in, so she's brought to the mikveh by a female, and she immerses up into her head, with her head out of the water, and only then are they going to come in. But then there are further steps that are taken to protect the Tznius beyond the coverage of the water, which may or may not be transparent water. But other steps are taken, such as having a garment involved. Maybe she's wearing very loose clothing, or maybe there's just a garment that's held up in between them, or maybe there's something with a hole in it that her head can fit through. And also the dayanin could be standing at a distance, which further obscures the view of the rest of the body. All of this is a part of the process of accommodating these two goals of, on the one hand, making sure that the gerus happens in a way that poskim are confident in, that it was done b'fnei Bez Din, but at the same time also protecting the multiple important goals of the halachic considerations of tznius, of the psychological considerations, of making sure that no one should feel victimized or objectified as a process of gerus, is obviously a very significant consideration, and all of this is what is being balanced as far as this practice is concerned. Efraim?
Yeah, if the dayanim wear glasses, do you make them take them off?
So in general, we don't assume glasses are chatzit. There is such a discussion, and it's an interesting discussion. Why not? But that's...
Not the woman, the dayanim.
Right, so they don't see the woman. Right, I understand. The chatzitza, right, I use the word chatzitza, which makes it sound like we're talking about the mikveh itself. So as we discussed yesterday, immersion in the mikveh requires a lack of chatzitzas. But also the question we say, seeing something. So is seeing something through glass considered to be a chatzitza? So I think in general we don't ask edim at a wedding that they have to take off their glasses when they watch what happens. So that's not the attitude that we generally take. It's an interesting discussion. Why not? It's a little bit outside of our scope for now. But the glasses, which directly enhance the act of vision, we don't treat that as a chatzitza for practical purposes, even though there was such a discussion.
Saying specifically in the realm of tznius. that they
don't see her as clearly. You're saying it should help. I see. I think you're asking for that. Right. You're saying, like some people recommend when you walk in the streets to take off your glasses. So here also, so say this will be a good pshara. So you'll be aware that it's her in the mikveh, but you won't be able to see anything too clearly. So I don't know. It's not going to help so much for the dayanim who have 20/20 vision. So, you know, it's it sounds like it's too weak of an approach. It's probably a good idea on a personal level for one who's trying to reduce their exposure to anything they shouldn't be seeing. But as far as giving confidence to the people around you that you're not bringing any kind of a violation onto them personally, I'm not sure. It seems a little bit too easily abused. Because there are people who don't need glasses in the first place. But as a personal suggestion, in other contexts, sometimes it has a place. But I thought you were asking in terms of when there's a halacha to see something that maybe not seeing through glasses is considered to be a consideration. Okay. So on that note, I will wish you a meaningful Shabbos Chazon, Shabbos of vision. But it should be a vision that we should be able to turn to positivity. And through our proper appreciation of all of its themes, may that indeed be the case. And God willing, I look forward to seeing you again on Monday. And should be only good things.
Thank you.
All right. Maury, can we organize a sheer Zoom basketball maybe?